Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin on this Labor Day with an assessment of what is driving the growing income and opportunity gap in America as our democracy is increasingly captured by plutocrats. Chuck Collins, the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires, and the author of Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good, joins us to discuss his new report at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. We will look into the growing divide that is not so much the result of technological change and globalization, but is embedded in our economic and political system, since we have reached the point where the top 1/10 of 1% own as much as the bottom 90% of U.S. households combined. Then we'll explore the reasons why union representation in the private sector has shrunk to below 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s, and why it has been attributed to American workers turning away from unions rather than the real cause, which is the hidden war against unions by the multi-billion dollar union-busting industry financed by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss the judiciary as an arm of the union-busting industry, with corporatist judges like Neil Gorsuch now poised to eviscerate public sector unions. Then finally, we'll speak with Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and author of The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, who has an article at inequality.org, A Hall of Fame Turns Shameful. We will discuss how the portrait of the union-busting President Reagan has been put up in the Labor Department's Hall of Fame alongside true heroes of labor like Cesar Chavez by Labor Secretary Acosta, who was appointed by Trump because of his hostility to American workers. And joining us on this Labor Day is Chuck Collins, who is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good, as well as being the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. He is the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity, The Moral Measure of the Economy, and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. His latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next Systems Project, Reversing Inequality and Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And I must say, watching the tragic pictures unfold down there in Houston, you do see a kind of apartheid in America between the wealthy and the poor. Not that the flood didn't also flood some wealthy homes, but we know that they've got insurance and that most of the people that were flooded out don't. And then the more that I've looked into it with people that live down there and specialists on coastal wetlands, etc., there's this chemical coast that they call it, where all of these chemical oil and gas infrastructure, it's also known as Cancer Alley. Much of that, of course, has been inundated by water, and all the pollutants are now swirling around in this toxic stew. But then when you look into the government of Texas, how they enabled these big oil and chemical companies to build plants in suburban neighborhoods, and the governor, Abbott, who casts himself as a good Christian, one of his first acts was to rescind the requirement for corporations, particularly those with dangerous chemicals, to make public the inventory of what they had on site. And of course, even as this plant's burning in Crosby, Texas, nobody knows what's about to explode because they're no longer required to do that. And Governor Abbott, before he made that decision after a fertilizer plant blew up in 2013, he took a whole bunch of money from the Koch brothers. And thus we have the results. So I'm beginning to see, at least in the state of Texas, a fairly clear example of a government that takes care of business and puts profit over people. How bad is that model? I mean, are we heading in that direction?
Yeah, I think, Ian, you described the toxic brew of growing inequality and our kind of ecological catastrophe in unfolding. I mean, it's very similar to Louisiana, where, you know, upstream from New Orleans, you have another cancer alley and the petrochemical industry. These are like petrol democracies or petrol dictatorships, where the government is really captured by the fossil fuel industry. It gets its way, and so when there is an ecological crisis like a mass hurricane, it really peels back kind of that intersection of plutocracy, kind of authoritarian politics and inequality, and the people who are suffering the most are the most vulnerable and the most low income and often communities of color, both in Texas and in Louisiana. You see that happening right before our eyes.
And of course, Governor Abbott is also one of the state governors that are pushing President Trump into rescinding the DACA agreement made under President Obama. And of course, everything that Obama did, Trump, he feels compelled to undo. But that could cause enormous amount of human suffering. You've got 800,000 kids with brothers and sisters and parents and friends that they could all be deported in a national trauma. So there's a kind of cruel streak going on here in our country, it seems.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, you kind of see the seeds of resistance in that. I mean, you know, they tried to reform a healthcare, and when it became clear that there were real human beings that were going to be affected by this sort of abstract ideology of theirs, that things kind of folded. And I think with DACA, you can't imagine. I mean, these are leading light young people in many communities. They are known individuals. They're hogging the honor rolls in their schools, and to sort of lead to their, you know, being kicked out of school or deportation is going to just tear communities apart. But I don't think people are going to put up with it. I actually think this is sort of like how far can you go down the line before people just say enough is enough? And I think each time we're kind of bumping up against these trip points where I think people are just going to be like, I can't believe this is what's going on, if there were deportations of the DACA students.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and The Patriotic Millionaires. And his books include Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. And his latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. So on this Labor Day, let's talk a little bit about your study, which is very, very comprehensive and very deep. But just to sort of encapsulate some of it, what you're saying is, for starters, we must know what we are up against. These inequalities do not spring mainly from technological change and globalization, though both compound and complicate the rift. Instead, imbalances of power and agency embedded in our political and economic systems are the main drivers and accelerators of inequality. So, in a nutshell, could you make the case that because we have money-driven politics, he who has the most money owns our politics? Is that at the heart of it, you know, in a simplistic sense?
Yeah, it's partly there's this cycle between, you know, kind of a corrupt governing system or a political system that's been captured now by big money. But what that leads to is the changes in the rules that govern the economy. So even if we sort of today cleaned up government, the rules of the economy, tax policy, trade policies, government spending priorities, just left on autopilot, would create greater and greater inequalities. So we need to reverse not only that sort of power imbalance, but we also have to change the rules to build a more of a shared prosperity economy. And, you know, the reason I wrote that study is because people are recognizing these inequalities, but they're proposing kind of milquetoast solutions. Oh, well, let's just invest in education, and that'll enable young people to kind of get into the market and compete. And it's just much more complicated than that now because of this unwieldy concentration of wealth and power that we're having to deal with.
So what is the, is it something inexorable, or is there a plan here? In other words, why would you want a country in which the billionaires, as you point out, I'll just read a little bit here to get some context. At the very pinnacle of U.S. wealth is the Forbes 400. Billionaires whose combined net worth totals $2.3 trillion. Together, this small group has more wealth than the bottom 61% of the U.S. population combined. The richest 100 have more wealth than the entire black population, over 14 million households. And the net worth of the wealthiest 20 billionaires, all of whom could sit in one Gulfstream 650 luxury jet, exceeds that of the bottom half of the U.S. population combined. So that, of course, really does give you a picture of the extraordinary excess. And as your co-author of the book Wealth in Our Commonwealth, Bill Gates Sr. once said, you can't sail two yachts at the same time. So what is driving this lust for obscene amounts of wealth?
Well, probably the first stage of inequality that we lived through sort of prior to 2000 was driven by, you know, CEOs taking more of the profits. Now, though, what we're seeing is wealth creating more wealth at an accelerating speed at the top. So the driving forces are almost sort of baked now into the economy. And that's one of the challenges. And I think, though, that the good news is that this is creating, the conditions for a political realignment. We've already lived through an election that was primarily about inequality, where there was a sort of populist uprising, whether it was going toward a Bernie Sanders populism or a regressive Donald Trump populism. But that's all being driven by the fact that real wages have been stagnant for half the population for almost four decades, and that concentration of wealth that you just described. And so there is a realignment. People want the wealthy to pay their share. They don't want to live in a plutocratic society. They'd rather, polls show, Americans would rather live in a society closer to Sweden, where there's a basic, decent safety net, and there isn't this grotesque imbalance of wealth at the top. So I think we are kind of, you know, running up against the sort of the last run at, you know, grabbing more money, taking the money and running, whether it's the fossil fuel industry or whether it's, you know, Wall Street financiers. The party is coming to a close. We just cannot sustain this. And even the ranks of the wealthy now are very clearly split. And you're seeing more and more wealthy people. There's this guy, Peter Jarjescu, who just wrote a book, Capitalists Arise. He's a big Wall Street advertising CEO. He's saying, look, this is completely unsustainable. It's not in anyone's interest to keep going down this path toward economic apartheid. So you're even seeing reasonable Wall Street voices just saying, this is not in anyone's interest to keep going down this road.
So that's a kind of play on the old international anthem of the working class. Arise, ye prisoners of starvation. Arise, ye capitalists.
That's right. It is.
It is. How
he's basically saying to his peers,
yeah,
you know, stagnant wages, collapsing middle class, mm-hmm. growing racial wealth divide. None of those are, you know, you don't want your children and grandchildren, you yourself don't want to live in a society where we're heading. But it's time to be part of intervening and reversing these inequalities.
But the engine that's driving that kind of wealth inequality, where you make money out of money, and frankly, the Koch brothers, who've become incredibly wealthy and extremely politically active, even though they started out with refineries and oil and gas infrastructure, etc., their wealth has multiplied through basically Wall Street, their investments, and playing and, you know, maximizing the kind of trading that goes on, high-speed trading and all this kind of stuff, which also this other billionaire that's extremely influential with the Trump White House, the biggest donor to Trump, Mercer, he's basically a guy that's a brilliant mathematician, and he developed a bunch of algorithms that essentially, use computers to make money out of money. So my question would be, in the broader sense, is if you have a capitalist system that's based on extracting wealth and not creating wealth, which after all, the robber barons, as tough as they were, they did create wealth. They didn't just keep extracting. Is that a dead end that we're heading towards? Can you reach a kind of Rubicon where you're just playing with money, making money out of money, in itself will bring down capitalism?
Well, I think you're right in that it's not sustainable. I mean, there was this phase of even under the robber baron wealth where they were definitely extracting from nature, but at a certain point, the concentration becomes, and we're seeing this in the incredible rate of mergers and acquisitions and corporate consolidation, and you start to see the economy eating its feed corn, the old expression, don't eat your seed corn. That's the capital you need to reinvest for the future, and there's a sort of self cannibalization quality to some of what's happening in the economy. I think that's part of, we've crossed that line, and kind of the real capitalists, the people who actually are kind of interested in making real goods and products and services, are starting to see how the Wall Street financiers are coming to squeeze them now. And they don't want to have any part of it. So you're seeing this break between the predatory, extractive, capitalists, the venture capitalists, the vultures preying on productive enterprises and undermining them, and some pushback from real, locally based businesses who are saying, stop extracting from and nickel and diming us at every turn of the way.
But something's happened, though. It seems to have gone somewhat under the radar, and that is that 10 years ago, you had the companies with the biggest market capitalization were ExxonMobil and Citibank, etc. Now, 10 years later, the biggest companies are Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. They all have enormous market capitalization.
Yeah.
The most powerful companies in the world. And they're not considered, as Google's motto is, don't do evil. Well, they're not considered evil. People like Apple products. They don't pollute like the oil companies do, etc. But they still are powerful monopolies. So how do you see them in this overall picture?
Well, I think we're just starting to understand just what does it mean when those actors... Now, clearly, Amazon is kind of in a different category because it is buying up Whole Foods and buying up and kind of putting Main Street retailers out. It's gone beyond books, and it's going to, destroying the retail sector in a lot of small communities where you're better off just ordering it through Amazon. And so you see vast swaths of the local retail sector evaporating. So that's a good example where unfair competition at the top, they're willing to sort of lose money to wipe out whole retail sectors, and then they'll come in and then they'll start making money because they'll jack up their prices. I do think there's now a little bit, it's interesting to see Google kind of pressing down on this liberal think tank, New America Foundation. They after this group of scholars basically said, isn't it great that Europe imposed those fines on Google and the United States should do the same? They threatened to withdraw their funding from this think tank. They forced the layoffs or firings of a number of people. So, but I think that there's going to be a revival of antitrust spirit, that these monopolies are fundamentally anti-competitive. They're actually undermining open markets. So professed capitalists who believe in real competition and open markets are appalled. And you can see it, we're getting nickel and dimed in every way. Beer, the cost of beer. There's two giant duopolies in the beer industry. Cable providers, cell phone providers. The fact that there's not competition costs us money as consumers. It's also destroying Main Street economies. The craft brewery industry has helped revitalize a lot of Main Streets around this country. A lot of small mill towns in New England have thriving new little economic upticks because of that. And the big duopolies in beer are trying to squeeze them out, snuff them out. So I think there's, again, you know, at a certain point, the math just becomes 99-1 or 999-1, you know, out of 1,000.
Right.
And if that's where, you know, we just have to say we're not going to take it anymore. We have to break up these monopolies that are, you know, eventually going to keep squeezing harder, going to keep squeezing the competition.
But just in closing, do you see you described the mill towns being revived by craft breweries. Is that a model on a broader landscape? In other words, you know, people talk about the end of work and deindustrialization and robotics taking over. Is it possible that we could create a kind of society that's more based on bartering and crafts and people's individual talents being transacted?
Well, I think that is one of the ways forward. You know, there's this tremendous new economy movement, the relocalization of food, but also manufacturing and production, beer being just one of those things. But, if you look around New England, there are these emerging new relocalized economies where people are saying, let's produce more of what we need here in the real economy. Let's protect our local economies from the big extractive actors. And let's push back against the monopolies or the Amazons of the world that are hoovering up, you know, the wealth of our communities, and let's keep more of it local. So more and more communities are trying to nail down as much of their commonwealth and commons and creating high road economies. And it's yet to be, you know, well, I think that's one of the ways forward for sure.
Well, Chuck Collins, I thank you very much for joining us on this Labor Day. It's been an interesting discussion, and I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian. Happy Labor Day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. And his books include Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. And his latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back exploring the reasons why union representation in the private sector has shrunk to below 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s.